The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Jeffersonville, Bloomington, and Lafayette, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jay Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
Hey, good evening to you. Or if you are listening in podcast form, to quote Sid Collins and Donald Davidson and others who have said it, good afternoon, good evening, good morning, whatever time it may be while you are listening. This is Beyond the Bricks. From the Bet365 Race Command Center, my name is Jake Query. Eddie Garrison is the engineer that puts together Beyond the Bricks for us, and Mike Thompson is the architect behind all of the fantastic sound and the anecdotes that you will hear over the course of this show. In year number four, this is the second installment of our show to kick off 2024. Mike, I will simply begin by saying, I guess we didn't necessarily get to this yesterday when talking about Gilles DeFerrin and Cale Yarborough, but we would be remiss if we did not extend our gratitude not only to those who listen to this show and ask us if we are going to do it again, which we are this year, and to those sponsors who make it possible for us, but also just simply, I think it is worth repeating, even though we've done it a lot, for the two of us. I know I speak for you in saying that it is the ultimate thrill and honor to be able to have a microphone and talk to folks about what is the greatest facility, the greatest sporting event in the world.
Oh, absolutely. Completely agree. It's really gratifying that all year I get asked, are we going to do Beyond the Bricks again? When does the show start? When I'm at the memorabilia show set up with my the memorabilia aspect of my life, I mean, countless people come up to me and say, hey, I listened to Beyond the Bricks the whole way up from Atlanta and things like that. I mean, it's really, really gratifying that we have this opportunity and really enjoy the opportunity to get to do this.
And what we are doing to begin this season of Beyond the Bricks is taking a look back. And I know that there are those that would say, morbid is the wrong word to use, but those that say, well, you're focusing on people who have passed. I think that's important. Because it's important because the Speedway, as we've talked about, the one thing about the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to me, Mike, that is so unique is that every year during the race, I look around at the beginning of the race and I look at all of the fans and all of the people and the workers and the yellow shirts, everybody. And I've said this before and I will say it another 1,000 times. The thing that makes that Speedway and that event so unique is that for each and every person, they feel not only a personal connection to the Speedway, but they also feel that their personal connection is more personal than the other 285,000 people around them. And to them it is. And nobody is wrong in that regard, but it is such a special place. And that is largely due to not just the traditions that we have each and every year, but because of the stories that are taking place before us as we watch the race. And one of those stories is a man who made 12 starts at the Indianapolis 500, was a rookie of the year at the Indianapolis 500, but also came from a family that not only had the ultimate triumphs when it came to racing, but experienced the ultimate heartaches when it comes to racing. Talking about Bill Vukovich Jr., who we lost on August 20th of the past year, August 20th in 2023. But Mike, when it comes to talking about those whose story is as personal as any at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, then Bill Vukovich Jr. would be right at the top of that list.
No question about it. We'll have a really poignant clip from Bill Vukovic the second here coming up in a few minutes. But I had a real personal connection with him. I didn't know Bill Vukovic the second really, really well. I met him several times, but I used to live in Avon, and Bill Vukovic the second lived in Avon. And there was one time I had an opportunity, Dick Jordan, who used he was just one of the most important people at USAC ever. He invited me one time. He used to have a poker game. And if you got invited to the poker game, you were somebody, because anybody who was anybody got invited to Mr. Jordan's poker game. I mean, I'm talking famous drivers, people from the sport. It was a who's who when I went to this poker game. It was just really, really special that I got invited. I got to go to one of the poker games at Mr. Jordan's house. But I drove over to Mr. Jordan's house, and as soon as I pulled in, Mr. Jordan said, "Hey, we got to go pick up Vukovic." And I said, "Okay." So I got right into Mr. Jordan's car. So we go to go pick up Bill Vukovic the second, and we're going down to Ann Jones Road in Avon. And anyone who ever rode with Mr. Jordan, apparently, this was the only time I ever rode with him. Mr. Jordan, he could put his foot down on the gas pedal. I can tell you that right now. So we're going down Dan Jones Road and probably 75 miles an hour. And so we're on our way to Mr. Vukovic's house. And then he takes this right turn to the road where Mr. Vukovic lived, at probably 45 miles an hour. And I'm literally texting my wife at the time. And Jake, you know my wife.
Texting my wife. Goodbyes at that point, right?
I literally texted my wife, and I said to my wife, I said, "If I don't make it home after this poker game, this is what happened." And so I'm not sure, you know, what's going to happen with this drive. So we pull into Mr. Vukovic's house. And the reason I'm telling this story is we open the door. And Mr. Vukovic says, "I'll get in the back seat." And so Mr. Jordan looks at Mr. Vukovic and starts doing this introduction. And he's like, he goes, "This is Mike Thompson. He's starting to give my like background and what I do and all this stuff." And literally Mr. Vukovic looks right at him and goes, "Dick, I know Mike." He says it just like that. And it was one of the most, I don't know how to explain it, Jake, other than prideful moments of my life, because Bill Vukovic the second says to him, "Well, I know him," you know, and I was just like sitting there going, "Well, that really kind of made my day. You know, he knows who I am," you know. So
that would have been the second text I would have sent.
Yeah. So I just was one of those really prideful moments, because I was just sitting there thinking, you know, hey, Bill Vukovic the second knows who I am. He's like, "I know Mike." And that's all he had to say. And so we went to the poker game, and it was just a really, really fun night. And that made my day. So, but I will tell you, I never rode again with Mr. Jordan after that. The next time we had to go somewhere, we drove in separate cars.
Well, you know, when it comes to cars in general, speed in general, danger in a car, Bill Vukovic and his father, of course, and his son, there's a long legacy that we will get into here. Bill Vukovic Jr., or Bill Vukovic the second, was a man who, of course, his father is one of the legendary names in the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500-mile race. We will talk upcoming in this month with Mark Monteith, who has a fabulous book that he did not write, but that he completed. And by that I mean that Angel Angiopoulos was a writer for the Indianapolis Star and News, I believe it was the Star, who wrote a book about Bill Vukovic, talking about the two-time winner Bill Vukovic. And he had completed the book, and then Vukovic, of course, was fatally injured in the Indianapolis 500-mile race in 1954, but Monteith found the manuscript. Actually, the nephew of Angel found the manuscript, and Mark Monteith decided to have the book completed and published. That book is out. Vukovic, the man who would not lift. And we will talk to Mark Monteith here on Beyond the Bricks this month about the book and the fantastic glimpse into the life of Bill Vukovic. But as I'd mentioned, Bill Vukovic was fatally injured in that race in 1955. I said 54, sorry. He won in 53 and 54, nearly won in 1952, won the race in 53 and 54, and then was fatally injured in 1955. And young Bill II, or Bill Jr., was listening to the race, Mike, but the reality is in the moment that Sid Collins announced that the injuries to Bill Vukovic and that accident had turned fatal, the young Bill Vukovic II did not hear that Sid Collins announcement, correct?
That's correct. He was listening on the radio and heard the accident and basically told members of his family at the time, well, my dad will be okay. You know, he imagined in his mind his dad standing behind the car, kind of kicking the car, you know, cursing his luck that he was out of the race. In his mind, well, my dad will be all right. But family members intervened before he could hear the announcement. And you mentioned Bill Vukovic Jr. He is technically not Bill Vukovic Jr. He occasionally, very, very occasionally, would sign autographs, Bill Vukovic Jr., but he is Bill Vukovic, or was Bill Vukovic II. His father didn't have a middle name, and so they're Bill Vukovic and Bill Vukovic II. So technically, he was known as Billy Vukovic a lot of the time, but he was Bill Vukovic II.
Well, of
but
course, yes, and then when... when his son, Billy Vukovic, started racing, known as Billy Vukovic III, then you also get into that complex area of it. You know what I mean?
That's correct.
His racing career was vast. And, of course, I think, Mike, we need to begin by talking about this, and that is the bravery, I guess, but at the same time, the passion that it shows in the sport of racing for somebody to get into a car and continue the legacy of their father, even knowing that racing essentially took their father from them when they were in their most impressionable years, but nonetheless, still being able to get into a race car and race as Bill Vukovic II did, but not only to do so carrying on that name, but to do so carrying on the name in a very competitive nature, Mike.
Yeah, and he actually said in an interview I listened to that he really wasn't interested in being a race car driver at first. Especially after his father's passing. And then he decided, this might be a path I might be interested in going down. But, he got competitive right away, doing some super modified races, some midget racing out on the West Coast, where they were from Fresno. And he was competitive right away and made the jump to the USAC in the mid-60s and was very quick, especially very, very good midget driver, excellent, excellent driver.
He started in super modifieds. He raced in midget racing. He moved to USAC in the mid-1960s. And then in 1968, carrying on the legacy of his father, who would have been fatally injured 13 years prior in the Indianapolis 500-mile race, Bill Vukovic II making his start in the Indianapolis 500. Sid Collins had the starting lineup in that year's race.
The eighth row. Car number 11, Gary Bettenhausen, a rookie, Tinley Park, Illinois, a Turbo Offie, the Thermo King Auto Air Conditioning Special. Number 98, a rookie, Bill Vukovic, Santa Rosa, California, Thermo King, Fresno, California, Bill Vukovic, Wagner Lockheed Brake Fluid Special.
And he would start 23rd in that race and finish in seventh in the 1968 Indianapolis 500. And coincidentally, by the way, you heard the other second-generation driver that would be in that race, not one but two of them in 1968, starting right alongside one another, correct, Mike?
Yeah, and that's what was interesting about that, that he started next to Gary Bettenhausen, whose father also had been fatally injured at the Speedway. And I was under the impression that he and Gary Bettenhausen, hit it off immediately and were always best friends. And because when you saw them together in later years, they were inseparable. They went to the Robin Miller lunches all the time and they were pals and at, Charlie Brown's and things like that. I thought that they were best friends from the beginning, but I found some audio not that long ago, actually, of Bill Vukovich II on Kevin Calabro's show, The Sports Huddle, in 1981. And he said, basically, I didn't care for Gary Bettenhausen at all at the beginning when I started racing, which I found fascinating, actually.
So this is, by the way, Bill Vukovich talking about Gary Bettenhausen with Kevin Calabro in 1981.
Well, I didn't like Gary a long time ago. We weren't very good friends when we first started racing. Right? It was a rivalry, and we ran real close, and we banged wheels on a few occasions. And one night at Manzanita Speedway, we got into a pretty bad wreck, and I think we finally worked in and decided we better become friends because it was a violent accident. Nobody got hurt, but somebody could have, and it was a push-and-shove type deal, and nobody was willing to give. And from that day on, I had a lot of respect for Gary, and I think he's got a lot of respect for me. And then after the respect was earned for each other, we became very close friends. Gary's one of my best friends now.
Bill Vukovich II talking about Gary Bettenhausen. When you look at Vukovich's career at Indianapolis, I think the race that jumps to mind is the one that was, unfortunately, one that many people probably would like to forget, and that was that 1973 race, just because, Mike, we've talked about it before on Beyond the Bricks, but for those that are unfamiliar, the 1973 Indianapolis 500 was one that, even though obviously Gordon Johncock won the race, it just was marred by tragedy from essentially all four corners.
Wants to forget. It was a great day for Bill Vukovich II. When he's interviewed afterwards, he's interviewed by Luke Walton, and he's kind of giddy in the interview. Actually, he's like, "Hey, I like money, and this is the most money I've ever won in a race." And he was, you know, kind of giddy a little bit about you know, how he had finished in the race. But it's definitely the, you know, there were so many problems. Obviously, we've talked about several times, and with the rain and the stoppages and the sad fatalities of during the month of two drivers and a pit crew member. So, you know, it was just a mess all around.
A few years ago, after an IndyCar race in Texas, I was flying back along with a number of IndyCar folks out of Dallas. And we took off. We were in the air for probably 30 or 45 minutes when the pilot came overhead to say that there was a mechanical issue and we were going to have to land and get it repaired. So we ended up getting diverted and landing in Austin, Texas. And we're there for quite some time, enough time that IndyCar ended up sending down a chartered plane to get everybody because there were so many people that were on the commercial flight. Sitting next to me at the gate was another couple who had been on that flight from Dallas because they were returning from an event in Fresno, California. And that couple was Bill Vukovich II and his wife, Joyce. And she asked why there were so many people involved in IndyCar on the flight, and I told her that we were coming back from a race, and she had told me, or she told me at that moment, well, my husband raced in the Indy 500, and it was Bill Vukovich II sitting next to her. Once IndyCar sent that plane, I went up to them and said, we probably should have Bill Vukovich II and his wife fly back as well, even though they're not with the traveling party per se. And they were, in fact, included in. And so I talked to them and got to know them over the course of that flight. And one of the things that we talked about, Joyce and I primarily, was the 1973 race. And the fact that, Mike, Joyce thought in a race that Bill Vukovich II would ultimately finish in the second position, but there was a point in the race where they came to her thinking that actually Vukovich was the leader and that she should prepare for Victory Circle because due to a timing and scoring issue before the end of the race, they momentarily had Vukovich II scored as the leader. And then were able to correct that, in fact, he was running in the second position. One of the things, Mike, that I always found to be impressive is the fact that even with that, and even where there are a lot of drivers that would go back and perhaps stake claim that they had won that race, unless I'm mistaken, to my knowledge, Bill Vukovic II never really raised any sort of a fuss over that. He was happy with and proud of his runner-up finish, and I think was congratulatory towards Gordon Johncock's win and left it at that. And that, to me, was always impressive.
Yeah, he was very proud of that second place finish. There was no question about that. Like I said, he was thrilled with the money aspect of it and the fact that he, you know, I mean, he was establishing himself. And then later that year, he got his only championship win at Michigan in one of the twin 125 deals they had that back then in September. So, you know, 1973 was a bad year in racing, but it was a pretty good year for Bill Vukovic II.
All told, 6 top 10 finishes in his 12 starts. And in 1975, he would finish 6th. He spun off the track and bounced right back onto it during a huge thunderstorm. Jackie Stewart was on the call and explains what happened with Bill Vukovic.
And there's cars all over the place. I just thought that with the act of cleaning and the amount of water on the road, cars are spinning, and look at this car.
That's Billy Vukovic.
Billy Vukovic's trying to control it. He's heading for the end of the road. He's coming up on the fence, and he's driving it away.
And have you ever seen that video, Jake, of that accident?
I have.
Well, it's not really an accident,
per se.
It
pales in comparison to the audio of Jackie Stewart describing it.
Yeah, but there's a man, if you've ever watched that video, when Bill Vukovic II spins off the track and hits backs into the fence, there's just a random guy standing there, and he misses the guy by about 2 feet and backs it into the fence and then drives it right away. But he just misses the guy very, very, I mean, just by a couple feet, basically. But yeah, Jackie Stewart, we missed Jackie Stewart on the call, man. He was great.
13 years after that incident, there would be another Vukovic to make a start at the Indianapolis 500-mile race, talking about Billy Vukovic III, who was a rookie in 1988, and he was an outstanding driver in his own right, winning Rookie of the Year at the 500, just as his father had done. He also, tragically, like Bill Vukovic's father, his son, Billy Vukovic III, was fatally injured in 1990, practicing for a sprint car race in California. In 2001, Bill Vukovic II gave a frank and honest assessment of the powerful losses that his family had suffered. When ESPN SportsCentury did a documentary on his father, here is Bill Vukovic II.
There's not going to be any more Vukovic's in a race car, and I'm glad of that. I mean, that suits me just fine. I still like racing a lot. But as far as dwelling on the three Vukovic's, I don't do that much anymore because they were bad memories.
August the 20th of 2023, Bill Vukovic II passed away, one of the legendary names and one of the true hearts and spirit of a champion that makes the Indianapolis 500 what it is. The contribution of the family is always appreciated by race fans and always thought of by those that come out to watch the greatest spectacle in racing. When we come back, another legendary name that has been lost since the last time we talked to you on Beyond the Bricks.
Life is full of things to manage. Your work, your family, your plans, and your treatment. Consider Kesimpta, ofatumumab 20 milligram injection. You can take it yourself from the comfort of home. If you're ready for something different, ask your healthcare provider about Kesimpta and check out the details at Kesimpta.com. Brought to you by Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation.
Even if you don't have a Kroger store nearby, you can still get Kroger groceries delivered that are guaranteed fresh. Order on the app and your groceries hit the road. With prices so low, you won't believe the savings. Get $25 off your first two orders, plus unlimited free delivery for $59 a year with a Boost membership. We'll bring all the fresh groceries you need from the store to your door. Kroger, fresh for everyone. $35 minimum order excludes alcohol and gift cards. Offer valid on delivery only with a digital coupon. Restrictions may apply. See site for details.
Life is full of things to manage. Your work, your family, your plans, and your treatment. Consider Kesimpta, ofatumumab 20 milligram injection. You can take it yourself from the comfort of home. If you're ready for something different, ask your healthcare provider about Kesimpta and check out the details at Kesimpta.com. Brought to you by Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation.
Feeling the midday drag? Break free from the allergy blues with Aspire Allergy and Sinus. Our dedicated team understands that every moment matters, and allergies shouldn't steal your focus. Picture a day without the constant sneezing and congestion. At Aspire Allergy, we specialize in personalized allergy testing and advanced treatments, ensuring you stay on top of your game. Take charge of your productivity. Visit AspireAllergy.com to schedule an appointment today. Aspire Allergy, where your midday revival begins. AspireAllergy.com.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
We'll have more on the automobile sounds and voices of the 70s. This is the Ontario Motor Speedway Network.
Here's another record recall from American Red Ball, the people who've made moving a spectator sport. Who's the only driver ever to have won both of the world's most famous auto races, the Indianapolis 500 and the 24 Hours of Le Mans? Here's a hint, he won both in the same year. We'll check your answer in just a moment. But first, do you have your own personal record book, a complete inventory of all your household furnishings and possessions? You should, and you can, just by calling American Red Ball. Whether you're moving or not, you can get a free copy of American Red Ball's helpful hints for moving and storage. This kind of record book helps you establish the household insurance coverage you need, and it's a valuable reference if your belongings are ever damaged or stolen. So get your valuable personal record book now, free, by calling 251-9501. Now to recall that record. The driver, of course, is A.J. Foyt of Houston, Texas. He won both the Indy 500 and the prestigious Le Mans Classic in 1967. Remember that one, and remember to call. Call American Red Ball. We've made moving a spectator sport.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Eddie Garrison handling controls here for Beyond the Bricks. We are inside the Bet365 Race Command Center talking about, if you were just listening, the previous segment, Bill Vukovich II, the Vukovich family in general and their contributions to racing and the loss of Bill Vukovich II in the last year since the last running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race, the last time that we were all together to talk about Beyond the Bricks. That was in August. And then, within the last week or so, one of the real giant names, Mike, in terms of racing history. He was born on December 12th of 1936, but it has been very recently that we have lost Wally Dallenbach Sr., and that is one of the legendary names in racing, of course, that also created his own contribution in the history of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Yeah, Wally Dallenbach was a great guy, and one of the reasons I picked that commercial to run was it was from the Ontario Radio Network, and Wally Dallenbach won at Ontario in 1973. That was his biggest win. He won the Ontario, the California 500 out there. Although, if somebody's listening right now, they're probably saying, well, that trivia question's wrong, and that's correct. Graham Hill ended up a couple years later. He won the 24-hour Le Mans, so he's another person who won the 500 and the 24-hour Le Mans since that trivia question happened in 1970. But Wally Dallenbach was just a great guy, hard-charging driver, won five championship races. One of the things that I think people, you know, kind of forget about Wally Dallenbach was how important he was as the chief steward of CART. He was chief steward of CART from 1980 to 2004, and he was very, very important. One of the most important things, I know you know, Jake, how important the traveling safety team is, you know, the Homatro safety team and the different, you know, safety teams that IndyCar has had over the years. You know, that was Wally Dallenbach who pioneered that. That was something that it was an innovation that Wally Dallenbach he was the guy who said, this is something we need to have, you know, a traveling safety team that goes from race to race to race, that these drivers know each week that it's the same people, that they can count on these guys. That was something Wally Dallenbach was the innovator of. And so he developed that as the chief steward of CART. And so that's an important innovation. He also was very important working with chassis manufacturers on, energy absorbent for crashes, so to take the energy away from the driver in crashes. And so Wally Dallenbach, in addition to having an important career on the track, he had a just as important of a career off the track.
Wally Dallenbach, again, I think that when you talk about great racing names, Mike, there are those, we talked yesterday about Cale Yarborough, for example, who it might get a little bit, for lack of a better phrase, lost in the overall totality of one's racing career. I mean, Dallenbach obviously had an incredible run at Indianapolis because this isn't somebody that just ran in terms of doing a couple of Indianapolis 500s. I mean, he ran 13 races of the Indianapolis 500. But among those, there were, like any driver, some races where you go in and it's just not your year, and then other races where you feel like you've got a really good shot. The best shot for Wally Dallenbach when it came to the Indianapolis 500 amongst his 13 starts probably, Mike, was in 1975.
Oh, definitely. I mean, if the rain comes a few minutes earlier or if his car can hold out a few minutes longer, then Wally Dallenbach's on the BorgWarner Trophy. I mean, there's no question about it. I mean, he had the dominant car. He led the most laps in 1975. And if those one of those two circumstances comes through for Wally Dallenbach, he's the winner in 1975. Unfortunately, his car burned a piston with on lap 162. And just a few minutes after his car dropped out, the rain came and Bobby Unser ended up being declared the winner.
So that 1975 race, 96 laps led, and then that burnt piston. This is how it sounded when Wally Dallenbach retired from the race.
All right, thank you, Luke. Everybody was standing up here. Did you see something on turn one, Ron?
Yes, and I did. Wally Dallenbach just went by us very, very slowly, and those telltale puffs of gray smoke coming up from the rear of that car. That's Wally Dallenbach, who was leader, and in car number 40, so you might watch for him.
All right, let's see if he's slowing down. Jerry on the backstretch.
Yes, he's going very slowly, Sid. He is now into number three, and that big puff of smoke coming out the rear of the car. I'm sure Doug Zink can see him, Sid.
Take it, Doug.
And he's down below the white line. And another puff of smoke as he reaccelerates. He's may very well be. Oh, big bunch of smoke now. He's over in turn four, Jim.
Okay, he's still trying to pour it on, but the smoke is pouring out. He's going to have to go into the pits. He's going to enter the pits just about right now, and that is a real shame.
Wally Dallenbach, as Mike had mentioned, won five races over the course of his career. Again, a pair of top four finishes at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, that race in 1975. And in addition to that, Mike, I think one of the things that is a good trivia question that perhaps some people forget about, and that was the unique circumstance in which Mario Andretti in the 1981 Indianapolis 500. We know so much about the way the race ended in 1981 for Mario Andretti. What some may forget is the way that it started in terms of the qualifying entry for Mario Andretti back in 81.
Yeah, that's right. Well, in 81, there was all kinds of rain problems on the first weekend of time trials, and Mario really needed to get into the field the first weekend, and it didn't happen. And so it worked out where Mario, the second weekend, he had a Formula One commitment that weekend. So they had to find somebody to qualify the car, put the car in the race for him because he wasn't going to be there. He was out of the country. He was in a Formula One race in Europe. So Wally Dallenbach had already retired, but he came out of retirement to drive for Patrick Racing, who he had driven for. We just listened to that clip in 1975. He was driving for Pat Patrick. They asked him and they said, hey, will you safely put this car in the show for Mario and then step out? And Mario's going to drive it on race weekend. And he did it. He put it in the show with no problem at all. Then graciously stepped right out of the car, did his job. And Mario was supposed to start 33rd. He actually didn't end up starting 33rd. He started 32nd because of the Tim Richmond situation. Tim Richmond ended up getting in George Snyder's car. So Richmond ended up starting back there. So it was a situation where Wally did his job just as asked, and Mario, you know, charged from 32nd and almost ended up winning the race from 32nd because of that. So, you know, Wally, that's just the kind of guy Wally was. He would, you know, hey, I'm asked to do a job, went out and did the job. And he was a very funny, just a funny guy too. I mean, I sent him a picture one time of him at Milwaukee that I asked him to sign. He lived in Colorado, and I'll always remember this. He lived on a road called Frying Pan Road. So you never would forget that because he lived on Frying Pan Road. He lived out in Colorado, and I mailed it to him, and he sent it back to me with a little sticky, you know, those little post-it sticky notes on it. And he put, "This isn't me, it's Mel Kenyon," because him and Kenyon were team cars at the time. And I knew it was him because that's why I sent it to him. And I kind of laughed about it. I was like, okay, well, he didn't sign it. Well, then I saw him at the Speedway about a year later, and I walked up to him and I asked him to sign it again. I said, "You said that this isn't you, but the person, the helmet says Wally right on it." And he looked at it really close, you know, kind of pulled it right up to his face, and he goes, "You know what?" And then there was this like 15-second pause, and he goes, "You're right. That is me." And then he signed the picture, and he was super, super nice about it, but got a big laugh out of it and everything.
So, and Mike, you had also mentioned earlier the fact that, you know, the safety innovations, but, you know, being the chief steward for CART from 1980 until 2004, the other thing that should be pointed out is the fact that that was an era, obviously, where there was all kinds of, I'll say controversy for lack of a better term, but just change in general. And obviously it goes without saying that open wheel racing in North America during that time period, leadership was important because there was a constant evolution, if you will, of the path and the trajectory of the sport.
Yeah. And one of the reasons that I think, you know, Donald and I have talked about this, you know, one of the reasons Wally Dallenbach was so effective in that role was he had been there. He had seen it all. You know, he had started in the mid 60s and, you know, had seen the evolution and the changes. And so he was uniquely qualified to be there. And what was great about Wally Dallenbach was, you know, you couldn't give him excuses and everything because he had seen it all, basically. So he was widely, widely respected. You won't find anybody who, you know, has anything bad to say about Wally Dallenbach as a chief steward. He was very, very well respected as the chief steward and did a fantastic job in that role.
Again, this is Beyond the Bricks. My name is Jake Query. I'm a midday host on 93.5, 107.5 The Fan in Indianapolis. Eddie Garrison, who is manning controls for us on this program, is the producer of that show, Query & Company, on middays. Mike Thompson, an audio historian, I will call him, of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. That's a fair term, is it not, Mike?
It is, and I want to give a shout-out to Eddie Garrison. We're glad to have Eddie Garrison back this year. You know, he's a big part of what we do, so shout-out to Eddie Garrison.
Eddie does a great job in putting together all of the audio that Mike sends over in Mike's vast collection, and Mike working in different capacities about the Indianapolis 500 and the Indianapolis Motor Speedway over the years from both a preservation of history standpoint and then also working in different media capacities over the years. And so that's how this program Beyond the Bricks comes together. It is, of course, an effort to keep alive the stories, the personalities, the contributors of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and the Indianapolis 500, and taking a look back at those that we have lost. And there are a couple more that we will discuss, as a matter of fact, when we return on the other side to the Bet365 Race Command Center and Beyond the Bricks.
Life is full of things to manage: your work, your family, your plans, and your treatment. Consider Kesimpta, ofatumumab 20 milligram injection. You can take it yourself from the comfort of home. If you're ready for something different, ask your healthcare provider about Kesimpta. And check out the details at Kesimpta.com. Brought to you by Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation.
What if you could have a career where the opportunities are as vast as our nation, where it's not about mission statements, but a shared mission? At U.S. Customs and Border Protection, we go beyond to protect more than borders. From ship to shore, air to ground, cities to local communities, CBP agents and officers are keeping people safe. Join U.S. Customs and Border Protection and go beyond for something far greater than yourself. Learn more at cbp.gov/careers.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, inside the Bet365 Race Control Center with Beyond the Bricks, talking about some of the drivers that we have lost from yesteryear at the Indianapolis 500, including a driver that made one start in 1965, but got a top 10 finish, starting in the 15th position and finishing in 6th place. If you have been to Mansfield, Ohio, which I have because it is not far from the Mid-Ohio Sports Car Course, and Mike Thompson, a native Buckeye, has been to Mansfield as well. There are two things that Mansfield probably is most, for which it's most known. One would be that it is the site of the Mansfield Reformatory and was almost entirely the filming location site for the epic movie, classic film, Shawshank Redemption. And Mike Thompson, if you can believe this, we are happening right now to be accompanied inside the Bet365 Race Control Center by one of the 9 living Americans yet to see Shawshank Redemption, because Eddie Garrison has never partaken in watching Shawshank.
That is impossible for me to believe that.
I know, right?
It's on TBS every weekend, man. Come on.
That's what I've said. It's like living in Orlando and not knowing what Disney is, right?
I mean, you could make 2 hours. It's on literally every weekend. There's got to be some time that you could just pop it.
And it's
it
also
there,
one of the top 10 movies ever made, correct?
Yeah. I mean, it's a great film. So on top, it's not like you're sitting down to watch, you know, Troll 2 or something.
Correct. That is correct. But speaking of top 10s, top 10 film, and Mickey Rupp is a guy that, as we talked about, made the Indianapolis 500, just one start, but finished in a top 10. And he, a native of Mansfield, Ohio. Mickey passed away back in August, but we take a look back now at his contribution to the Indianapolis 500 mile race. Mike, tell me a little bit about Mickey Rupp.
So Mickey Rupp, what's interesting about him was he was a sponsor before he ever got in the cockpit as a driver. He sponsored, his brother-in-law was A.J. Watson, the master mechanic, who was also from Mansfield, Ohio. And he sponsored cars, A.J. Foyt's car that A.J. Watson prepared, you know, in sprint cars and things like that. Mickey Rupp was the sponsor because Mickey Rupp had a product called the Dart Cart. So if you ever see pictures of A.J. Foyt driving the Dart Cart car for A.J. Watson, that was Mickey Rupp. Mickey Rupp was the guy behind that company. And he also sponsored Don Davis's car in 1961 at the Indianapolis 500. It was the Dart Cart special, basically. So Mickey Rupp has an interesting career because he was a sponsor before he ever got in the cockpit as a driver. And then he, in 1965, took his rookie test, passed his rookie test, and then got in a rear engine car, the Central Excavating Special, and made the race.
Again, 1965 was a special year at the Indianapolis 500-mile race. You would think that finishing sixth would automatically allow you to walk away with Rookie of the Year honors. For Mickey Rupp, it wasn't necessarily that way. Here's Donald Davidson on Mickey Rupp as a driver, the Speedway historian emeritus, Donald Davidson.
And then he qualified a rear engine car for Pete Salemi. It qualified as the Central Excavating Special. It was a Gerhardt, Offey, normally aspirated. And because G.C. Murphy stores were on a couple of cars that had missed the show, the sponsorship was transferred, or an arrangement was made whereby the Central Excavating car for race day ran as the G.C. Murphy store special. And Mickey Rupp finished sixth. And it was his only 500 because he quit very shortly after that. He went to Milwaukee for the next race, which was a 100-miler then, and he finished fifth. And then he didn't run again until the Milwaukee 200 in August, and I think he didn't finish that one. And that was his last race.
When you think about that 1965 field, one would be very impressed over the fact that to finish sixth as a rookie, but that was a loaded rookie class because you had Al Unser in that rookie class, George Schneider was in that rookie class, Jerry Grant was in that rookie class, Joe Leonard was in that rookie class, and Mickey Rupp finished behind a couple of other rookies. You might have heard of them, Gordon Johncock, Mario Andretti, amongst those that finished in the top six. More from Donald Davidson.
He finished sixth, which in a lot of years would have earned him Rookie of the Year, but unfortunately he was up against Mario Andretti, Al Unser, Joe Leonard, Billy Foster, Mastin Gregory, Gordon Johncock. I mean, that was the year of the most amazing, Bobby Johns' most amazing set of rookies. 11 of the 33 were rookies. The names that I mentioned, and Mickey Rupp is sort of almost like the stumper.
Mickey Rupp, one of those names, Mike, that when you hear it, it may not jump out at you as somebody that had the vast career that those others did, but obviously one more than worthy of our recognition today.
Yeah, just an interesting career as a sponsor and as a driver. I mean, he had a top 10 in his only Indianapolis 500, and he's one of the greats who made the field. So a really interesting career. And then at the end of 1965, he just said, you know what, I'm going to retire again. And he concentrated on his businesses. He had a recreational vehicle business and a marine business, and he was very successful doing all of it.
And when we look back at drivers that, you know, within the last year since the last running of the Indianapolis 500 that we have lost, there's another that we should mention. He was a driver that was known for the 70s and running, and I'm talking about John Mailer.
Yeah, John Mailer was a really, really good guy. And I had a couple of interesting discussions with John Mailer, because he was interested in history. And John Mailer made the 500 a couple of times, and people might remember the fact that in 1979, John Mailer put in a car in the 500 that basically had been parts laying on a garage floor the night before. The car got put together at the last minute. John Mailer never even drove the car, got in the car at the last minute, bumped his way in, actually bumped Bill Vukovich the second out of the race, hadn't even sat in the car until he went to the qualifying line at the time the gun went off. And so it was one of the most dramatic bumps in the history of the race in 1979. So John Mailer, you know, he bumped his way in, and he, you know, he drove in the 500 a couple times. And what was neat about John Mailer is he was really interested in history aspect of the race. And he one time reached out to me, because I ended up with a bunch of patches that the Champion Spark Plug Company was asked by a man named Tom Smith, who lived down in Frankfort, Ohio, to reproduce the famous, I know you've seen them, Jake, the famous Champion 100 mile an hour club patches. And they were asked to reproduce them for drivers who, you know, maybe their patch had been frayed or didn't, you know, wasn't good anymore or anything like that. So this guy, Tom Smith, asked permission from Champion to reproduce them. So after Tom Smith passed away, I ended up buying the remaining stock of these patches. And somehow John Mailer found out I had them. And John Mailer asked me basically if he could get a set of these patches, because, as you know, back in the day, if you completed the 500 miles at over 100 miles an hour, you got a set of patches. You were in the Champion 100 mile an hour club. Well, the club was gone and well before John Mailer, you know, ever made the 500. And he asked whether or not he could have a set of patches, because he wanted them. He wanted to have a jacket just like the guys in the 50s and 60s, you know, those kind of guys did. So I was like, this is really cool. John Mailer wants a set of patches. And technically, under the rules, John Mailer wouldn't have qualified for the Champion 100 mile an hour club. But what am I going to do? What am I going to say to John Mailer? No, you can't have the patches, because right, you technically didn't qualify for the 100 mile an hour club. So no, I sent him the set of patches, and he was very appreciative. And I've sent several other drivers who asked, Donnie Allison actually asked me for a set of patches, and I sent him one. And Johnny Rutherford, we gave him a 100 mile an hour jacket a few years ago. And it's been really cool. But it just shows you that guy like John Mailer, you know, he's one of the 795, you know, starting drivers in the history of the Indianapolis 500. And it meant so much to him to have one of those, you know, Champion 100 mile an hour jackets to show that, you know, hey, I'm in that fraternity. I'm in that group of drivers who drove in the Indianapolis 500. And that's what I'll always remember about John Mailer, was how much that meant to him.
And for those who have contributed to the race in so many different areas, it's what makes it possible for us to sit here each and every night and do a show that people can listen to and hopefully enjoy. In fact, we enjoy it so much, Mike, I say we do it again tomorrow night. Sound good to you?
It sounds good to me. I'm in.
All right, I'm in as well. Eddie, you in?
Well, as long as you get Eddie Garrison to watch Shawshank Redemption before tomorrow night's show.
Okay. Eddie, there's your assignment. There's your homework assignment. We'll be back tomorrow night. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
ADP knows anything you hear Anything you don't hear. Anything you kinda heard. Anything you weren't supposed to hear and now have to pretend like you didn't can change the world of work. From HR to payroll, ADP designs forward-thinking solutions to take on the next anything.